Good morning, folks. I think we're gonna get started. So if folks can come in and take their seats. I'm Bruce Katz. I'm a vice president of the Brookings Institution, and I'm a director of the Metropolitan Policy Program here. We're here today to have a very timely forum on the fiscal challenges facing cities and metropolitan areas in the United States and the implications for the economic recovery. As many of you know, the standing contention of our program at Brookings is that we are a metropolitan nation, that the national economy is essentially the makeup of a network of metropolitan economies. And so national economic recovery from the current downturn very much depends on the recovery of metropolitan economies. Today we're going to be discussing how, to a large extent, the recovery of metros depends to a meaningful degree on cities and other local governments being fiscally healthy. It's not yet been covered too much in the mainstream public discourse, but given the worst recession we've seen in decades, a potentially overwhelming local government fiscal crisis is now looming on the horizon. Now, our partners at the National League of Cities have conducted a very timely survey showing that nearly 9 in 10 city finance officers are reporting difficulties in meeting fiscal needs in 2009 and expect the same in 2010. The pain is widespread, from foreclosure-stricken cities and metros like Phoenix and Vegas to areas like Cleveland and St. Louis and New York, suffering losses in auto and manufacturing industries and financial services, and those places that are heavily reliant on state local aid in Massachusetts, New Jersey, most of the Northeast. And all this local level stress has serious implications for the national economic recovery. Over the next couple of years, just as the federal recovery spending trails off, continuing local government budget tightening and expenditure cuts could impose a significant drag on the economy, even as it's about to turn the corner. Now, as we all know, when cities and suburban municipalities make cutbacks, they lay off workers, they furlough workers, they cancel vendor contracts, and they eliminate funding to nonprofit providers, all of which directly removes demand from local and regional economies because numerous individuals and organizations across the metro are left with less money to spend on salaries, supplies, or consumption. That's the dynamic facing cities and many suburbs all across the country. So again, to put it simply, there can't be a healthy national economy without healthy local and regional economies. In that vein, I think today's conversation is going to lead to some thought-provoking conversation on the position of cities in today's economy, their future prospects, and the relationships to state and local governments. Mayors are making tough decisions, and that's what you're going to hear today. They're being incredibly creative to reduce the carnage. And we may need additional federal intervention beyond the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act to stave off real disruption at the local level in the next year. Now, before we turn to the rest of the day, I want to take a moment to introduce Don Bort, who's the executive director of the National League of Cities, which is co-hosting our event today, and ask him to make a few remarks. Now, Don, I got to give you the proper introduction here as a co-sponsor. Don is the executive director of the National League of Cities. That is the oldest and largest national organization which represents municipal governments in this country. Importantly, he has more than 35 years' experience in municipal government and the public interest sector. You probably go back to which recession in the 70s or the 80s that we might learn some lessons from. But he is uniquely experienced to talk to us today as a thought leader on these issues.
Thank you, Bruce. We're delighted to be here. As Bruce said, the National League of Cities is the oldest and largest organization representing cities, and indeed through a network of state municipal leagues, we represent over 18,000 city, towns, and villages across the country. Local governments, as Bruce has said, and I think you're all aware, are facing unprecedented fiscal challenges. This is unknown for our generation. Fortunately, local elected officials are what I like to refer to as prudent optimists. They acknowledge the realities that they confront. They make tough budget decisions. And what they try to do is maximize the services. That is, even though they're making cuts, what they try to do is provide services so that it seems seamless. There is, however, a tipping point. There is a point that as revenues are reduced, there are consequences for programs. And one of the problems is that the public often hears about the cuts, they see no changes in services, and they conclude that city governments can do more if you give them less. But that doesn't work. There is a point where there is going to be consequences. Now, for the last 25 years, the National League of Cities has been doing a fiscal survey. And my colleague, Chris Haney, is going to give you the specifics of the findings this year. But based on the studies that we have done, the longitudinal studies, we have been pretty good at forecasting what the consequences are going to be after a downturn. And right now, it really appears that it's going to be 18 months to 24 months before we see any kind of uptick in terms of what happens to the budgets of local governments. Now, for the past two or three decades, the cities have really looked to the federal government more from a defensive perspective than an ask perspective. They've been concerned about unfunded federal mandates, which we sometimes refer to as shift and shaft federalism. They're also concerned about preemption, federal preemption. But at the same time, if you go back to the 70s, city budgets had received about 17% of their revenue from federal programs. Right now, it's maybe 5%. So there's really been a decrease in the kind of support that local governments have received from the federal government. Now, from our perspective, the increase in unfunded federal mandates, preemption, and the reduction in federal assistance reflect an unraveling of the intergovernmental system, an inattention to and a disregard of the fundamental interdependence of local, state, and federal government. As Bruce has made pretty clear, our national economy is really the sum of the metropolitan or regional economies, making it imperative for state and local and federal governments to collaborate in order to address the dramatic fiscal crisis we confront today. At this moment, we need to recreate that intergovernmental partnership that operated two to three decades ago. In fact, our colleagues at the National Association of Counties have framed this in terms of restoring the federal partnership. The mayors you're going to hear from today will describe their reality as they make the tough but responsible expenditure reductions to match falling revenues that they confront in their communities. At this moment, however, we again need to acknowledge that we have a federal system, a system requiring an appreciation of our fiscal interdependence. That's what we want to address today. Thank you very much.
Okay, shift and shaft federalism. Okay, whoever came up with that line deserves an extra bonus at the end of the year, which, of course, we can't pay. So given the downturn. We're going to start with two experts today to focus first on the broader economy and then really shift to the fiscal implications for cities and suburban communities. So first up, we're going to have Steve Cochran from moodyseconomy.com. He's a managing director there. He oversees the U.S. Regional Forecasting Service and directs the research and development of really what is probably the leading institution right now doing this kind of work. Don't get up yet. And then we're going to be followed by Chris Haney. Chris is from the League of Cities. He's the director of the Center for Research and Innovation there. He oversees a broad array of research at this organization, which does really quality, independent, rigorous work. And his areas of expertise include much of what we're going to talk about today, which is local and state finance, federalism, and local government structure. So, Steve.
Thanks so much. It's a real pleasure to be here and to be given the opportunity to set the stage for today's discussion. I want to divide my talk into three very short parts. First, I will give you just a very brief outlook on the U.S. economy today, what that means for the regions and the metropolitan areas around the country. Second, I want to illustrate what I think are the most important risks to that outlook are right now. And I'll tell you right now, I'll be focusing on consumer spending and on housing markets. And third, we'll be looking quickly at implications that they have for city fiscal conditions. So, let me jump right in here. The recession is over, even though it may not really feel like it's over. Our estimate is that the recession did end in the month of August. The bar on the right-hand side of each of these quarters, the blue bar, is our estimate and our outlook for annualized growth of real GDP for the U.S., broadest measure of the economy. And we estimate that right now the economy is growing at about a rate of about 3% per year. Although you'll see that if you look at the right-hand bar, which is the green bar, that is our estimate of the contribution of federal stimulus spending to economic growth. And you can see that a good part of the economic growth today really is due to the active role of the federal stimulus programs right now. The risk is that most of the effect of stimulus spending happens when spending ramps up. That's when the biggest impact is. So when it levels off, and then even more importantly, when it begins to fade in coming quarters, that the economy has to pick up in a self-sustaining a pattern without so much help from policy. And so you can see that we expect that with that blue bar showing actually very slow growth first half of 2010, and then picking up as the economy gains some speed second half of 2010 into 2011. It does seem a little bit fragile right now with the unemployment rate jumping in October up over 10% to 10.2%. It could very well be higher than that right now. It really does make us feel like the recovery is fragile. Yesterday there was a report, too, of housing starts, home construction. That fell in the month of October as well. One reason why things seem so fragile is that there isn't a whole lot of hiring going on in the economy right now. Layoffs have abated, and that's what I show on the green line here, which should be red on the right-hand axis. You can see that layoffs really peaked back in the first quarter when there was so much panic in the economy, when nobody really, really had a good handle on what was happening and where the economy is going to go. Layoffs have abated, but nobody is really hiring. There's not enough confidence yet among employers to actually go out and ramp up again, and they're just holding their own. And that's one reason why productivity growth actually is very quick right now. But there is no hiring, and that is allowing the unemployment rate to rise even as the labor force does shrink. You can see in this map where the weakness is. The states that are red here are the states where the unemployment rate has risen the highest from there. I take each state's low point of the unemployment rate, which was usually in late 06 or early 07, and compare it to the latest unemployment rate. And you can see that it's the West Coast, it is much of the Southeast, and it is parts of the industrial Midwest where the unemployment rate has risen the highest. If labor force wasn't shrinking in parts of the industrial Midwest, you'd actually see more red in places like Ohio and Indiana and Wisconsin. The risk here is that when the unemployment rate rises as fast as it is in some of these areas, that's where there's the most slack in the labor market, and that means potentially there's the least potential in the near term for any improvement in wage growth because of the excess supply of labor in many of these markets. And weak wage growth will mean weak income growth. And we can see, actually, that weak income growth is already evident. In fact, as of the second quarter, which is our latest read on personal income growth for the states, income was down over the year, actually in every state except in the Dakotas. And where it was down the most was, again, on the red states on this map. And so it's the West Coast, largely hit by housing. Florida, also hit by the housing downturn. The industrial Midwest, hit by the downturn in auto production, other demand for durable goods, and New York, southern New England, and North Carolina, which were hit so hard by finance. So housing, finance, manufacturing, those are the real three defining factors that are driving the pattern of regional economic growth right now. Now, this weakness in income and the weakness in labor markets in these areas generates the first risk that I mentioned, and that's a risk of an extended period of very weak consumer spending. And if consumer spending is weak, that means, of course, weak sales tax revenue growth, and that will hit cities very hard that depend on sales taxes. It also means fairly weak income tax revenue. That's less important for cities, more important for states, but, of course, some of that is shared down to cities as well. So that's the first risk. The second risk relates to the housing market, that if labor markets continue to be very weak, that will probably lead to more pressure in terms of mortgage foreclosures and weakness in housing markets around the country. And what I show in this chart is evidence of the already a strong potential for rising foreclosures in 2010. This is the pipeline, in a sense, a measure of the pipeline of potential foreclosures going forward. Data from Equifax, a database that we manage with Equifax, one of the credit rating bureaus. And it is it takes the number of first mortgage loans that are delinquent 90 days or over, or that already are on the books of lenders as REO, real estate owned property, or where there is a notice of default. And you can see that has continued to rise through the third quarter and generates potential for a rising number of foreclosures into 2010 before that situation begins to abate. And then if we attack on that, the potential for a weaker labor market, it could make it even worse. And it could make it worse largely in these areas. This map, a map of all of the metropolitan areas in the country, is a map of our estimate of the potential for house price decline. This is our leading house price indicator. Where there's no color on the metropolitan areas, it means those areas don't differ from, broadly speaking, the U.S. average. But the blue and the red metropolitan areas are those that are at heightened risk of further house price declines. And you can see it's largely central and southern California, coastal Florida, and much of the Northeast, say from Washington up to New York and southern New England. These are areas where, again, the labor markets are weak, where there's a lot of subprime lending, or where income growth has slowed considerably, as it has in the Northeast. Also in the Northeast, house prices actually haven't fallen as much as elsewhere, and they're still, in our estimate, a bit overpriced in much of the Northeast. I think the mayors that are with us today might be happy to know that none of the metropolitan areas that contain your cities have a color here, and that's probably good news for you. But again, things seem fragile, and the turnaround will be slow. Our estimate is that the unemployment rate will continue to rise and will peak close to 11%, probably sometime mid-2010 to third quarter 2010, and that employment, payroll employment, which is the blue line, probably won't return back to a peak, back to its previous peak, until maybe sometime in mid to late 2012. And again, if we take that down to the regional level, you can see where this would have the greatest impact. The colors here indicate timing of when we expect that total payroll employment will recover completely and reach a new peak. The red states are the slowest. And they will reach a new peak sometime after 2013, could be 2013, 2014, or in some cases, as say in Michigan, they may never actually come back to where they were before. I think it's important to look at it in this way, because it's when employment returns to a peak that we'll truly see an impact on the broader economy. That's when we'll see tightening in labor markets. Wage rates should begin to rise again. We'll see better demand for office space, so office buildings will begin to fill up again. New construction for office space could commence once we reach this point in each of the state economies. Housing demand would improve, and the broader economy would look much better once we reach this point in each of the states. You can see that broad midsection of the country, from Texas, say, up to the Dakotas and into the Rockies, it will fare the best. It has the smallest hole to climb out of, and the housing cycle and the labor market cycle is much more shallow in that part of the country. Local government does its best during these times in terms of trying to stabilize the labor market. Sometimes it's not done intentional. It's simply that the tax cycle is often lagged behind the economic cycle, and the employment cycle in local government often lags as well. This chart shows local government employment as a share of total payroll employment in the U.S., and I split it up by education, local government education, that would be public K-12, and non-education local government employment. If you add those up, local government accounts for about 11% of employment today, nearly a record peak. It hasn't been this high since back in the 1970s. You can see there's a bit of a cyclical pattern to it. As the economy enters recession and comes out of recession, the share actually begins to rise because private payrolls tend to be cut first. It's a little slower for local government to cut payrolls, partly because, again, the tax revenue is a little bit lagged. But we're at a peak. Local government probably can't play this role much longer. We know fiscal conditions are so difficult at the local government level. Right now, one of the key factors helping local government employment to stay where it is the federal stimulus spending that is being directed directly to education. The green line here simply shows the spike in federal grants and aid to state and local governments specifically for education. But, of course, we know that can't last, and that cities will have to depend more on private employers ultimately to pick up the slack, begin hiring, and get the economy going again. Another problem for local government is that this difficulty in terms of maintaining local payrolls comes at a time when there is diminished state support for local government. What this chart shows, the blue line is the unemployment rate, and the green line is local revenue from local revenue that is derived from state governments, the year-to-year change in that. And what I want to illustrate, or what I want you to see or notice, is that when unemployment peaks, the contribution from state government toward local government revenue is at its lowest. In other words, that's an easy fix for state government, is simply to pull back from support for local government when state government budgets are in a difficult situation. Now, my data here only goes through 06. This is quite lag data, but I expect that it is happening right now, and actually will continue to happen through 2010 as state governments themselves grapple with their own fiscal difficulties, and there'll be less available left over for local government. But it's not only a near-term issue for, say, fiscal 2011. It actually could be more of a long-term issue because of what could be potential diminishment of the effectiveness of state tax policy. This chart shows our forecast of state tax revenue as a share of total U.S. GDP. And you can see that we do expect it to come back, but not as robustly as in the past, for two reasons. One is that is demographics. And that is that as baby boomers age, their spending patterns change, and they will shift spending from purchases of durable goods, which to a large extent drive sales tax revenue, to services, which are less important in driving sales tax revenue. And the second is the labor force, and that is that the labor force has shrunk, and if the labor force participation rate continues to be below historical norm, then there will probably be some downward weight on income tax revenue as well. So all this indicates that we have problems in the near term, but potential problems longer term, and it's going to generate a huge need for a lot of creativity on the part of city government and local government broadly, but also on generating new kinds of partnerships and new kinds of ways of generating and maintaining revenue at all levels of government. Thank you.
Like Steve, I'd like to thank you all for coming here today and being a part of the discussion that we've set up. My name is Chris Haney. I work for the National League of Cities. And I'm here to talk to you about the city fiscal outlook, to take what Steve has just put before you and talk about, to narrow it down into what's happening with city finances. So this is the sort of continuing analytic part of the program. As many of you know, the thing about economists and fiscal analysts is we're people that are pretty good with numbers but don't quite have the personality to be accountants. So our apologies for all the charts, and our apologies to the accountants in the room. I wanted to dovetail off of what Steve's presented here today and talk a little bit about work we've done on city finances for the last 25 years and focus on a report that we released, City Fiscal Conditions in 2009, that came out in September and is our latest information about what's happening. We've done this work, as Don said, and I just indicated, for the last 25 years with Mike Pagano, who I believe is in the room here. He's from the University of Illinois at Chicago. And some of what I'll present is done with Mark Miro here at Brookings, and you have both publications that we've produced off of that in your packets here. I want to underscore something both Bruce and Don and several others have said here, which is to the importance of local and regional economies to the national economy and national economic performance as a source of jobs and wages as a source of stimulus in the sense of the spin-off activity that happens when local governments invest in things like infrastructure, schools, public safety, and in the sense that, as Steve just showed, that up until recently, local governments were increasing that investment and may now be in a period of decreasing it, and that that may have a lag effect in terms of dragging down what happens in terms of national economic performance. Let's see here. So what I'm going to present to you today are the mostly results from our fiscal survey. We do this survey every year. It's a survey that goes out to the nation's city finance officers around the country. It asks them for directional types of their sense of direction in terms of what's happening with their economies, and it asks them for their hard budget data, which we then put into a format that we can report on in aggregate for the municipal sector. And here's what they told us. This is the sort of summary part. For 2009, they're worried about declining housing values, slowed consumer spending, rising unemployment and wages, and restrictive credit markets. And why are all of these important? Well, you heard Steve say some of this already. The housing values drive property taxes. The consumer spending drives sales taxes. The wage effects of unemployment drive local income taxes, which are important to a number of larger cities around the country in particular. And the restrictive credit markets has made it difficult off and on in this recession, and likely will in the future in terms of their ability to secure debt for capital projects and infrastructure investments. So in short, our finance officers in cities around the country are saying they're concerned about nearly every major source of revenue that they have in their budgets. And so it's not surprising that this next chart shows that 88%, the yellow bar on the far right here, that 88% of the city finance officers, when asked about whether they're better able or less able to meet their needs in 2009 versus the previous year, said they were less able to meet those needs. And historically, across the history of our survey, and it goes a little further back than this, this is the highest number. So it's indicative of the depth of the recession even at this point. And when we ask them the same question in terms of a prediction for fiscal year 2010, the number stays essentially the same. So it's fairly ubiquitous at this point. They're expecting things to be tough. Of course, the real numbers we pay attention to here are about revenue and spending trends. This chart's a little bit of PowerPoint terrorism, but bear with me for just a second, and I'll explain what the three important points about it. First is to explain that this is general fund revenues and expenditures for the municipal sector, as if we added all the budget numbers up together. And I want to point you to first two pieces. The far right, the blue bar is revenue, the yellow bar is expenditures, and everything's been adjusted for inflation, so these are in constant dollars. And the first piece is that revenues for 2009 are down just a little bit, right? But expenditures are still up. It shows that across the municipal sector there's about a 3% gap. And as most of you know, local governments around the country, city governments, have to balance their budgets under state law. So that's a 3% gap that has to be filled by the end of the fiscal year for these local governments. But it's not necessarily a huge number yet, is the other piece I would note. And this data is a little old at this point, actually. This is based on the survey we did back in May and June. So we're pretty sure that gap's probably widened in terms of what had to be filled. But we're still early, and that's a point I'm going to hit here repeatedly over the next few minutes. The second piece that I want to draw your attention to then is these gray vertical bars that appear earlier in the chart that represent the low point for the recessions, our two previous recessions in 1991 and 2001, respectively. If you then skate forward a couple of years and you look to where the revenue and expenditure numbers for cities hit their low, what you'll see is that the low point for cities typically comes 18 months to 24 months after the low point for the recession. And that's important in the sense that if we're at the low point now, or we've just turned the corner, it means we're still a couple of years away from seeing the low point for revenues and the point at which the curve starts to tick back up. The third piece I also want to highlight then out of this chart is to then look at the 1991 recession point in particular, because it's the one that probably most closely approximates what we're in now in the sense that it was a housing decline-fueled recession in some respects. And it took 4 years, essentially, before there was any real significant growth, annual growth, in local government revenues. And even after that, there were some fairly slow periods. Housing markets tend to come back slowly. City revenues tend to lag what happens in those markets. And so it's going to take a couple of years plus even the out years before we're going to see real significant growth here. So in essence, if we've passed the low point, we have a while to go before we come out of the woods here. We've got a while to go before we see significant revenue growth. And what's the main reason for that? Well, the overarching reason is mainly the local property tax, which is nearly ubiquitous across the country in terms of local governments having some access to it or getting some revenue from it, although that's not universally true, and we had, at least until recently, one case of that here in the room with us today. But I wanted to talk a little bit about what's happening with the property tax in reference to other local taxes. And so this chart breaks those revenue numbers, those general fund revenue numbers, down by property tax in the gray, sales tax in the blue, and income tax in the yellow. And if you go to the far right for 2009, what you'll see is that those revenue numbers that were down are being driven by income and sales tax revenue reductions. But the property tax revenue is still up. And that just doesn't jive with what we know is happening in the housing markets, which started to decline in mid-2007. The point here is that the full effect of property tax revenue of the housing market decline on property tax revenue is still coming, and it's coming in 2010, in 2011, in 2012, and it's going to be made worse actually by two factors. One of which Steve showed in terms of the spike in foreclosures that's likely coming. And most of the local officials around the country have been telling us they're expecting come January 2010 they're going to see a pretty significant increase. And the second factor is that right now what's been happening with the property tax has been mostly a residential story, where your individual housing values went down. But the next shoe to drop is actually the commercial property market. Kiplinger just reported that that's down about 35% across the U.S. this year. And that commercial property market's very significant in terms of driving local property tax revenues. And so that the numbers likely get much worse here over the next couple of years. And so that probably leads you all to be asking, okay, so how are cities responding? And you're going to hear from four mayors here today who are going to talk a lot about that in detail in terms of the choices that they're making. I'm going to highlight the two main responses to our survey in terms of how they've been responding so far. In 2009, 67% said they have instituted some sort of hiring freeze or have been laying people off or have been instituting some sort of furlough program, and 62% said they've delayed or canceled capital infrastructure projects. There's a reason these two things are first on the list. It's where the big money is, for one, right, in terms of workforce and capital projects, which are very large projects. But two, the local officials are seeing what's coming, right? Both, if you make cuts in these two arenas, you save money in out years. These are multiple-year capital infrastructure projects, and if you cut your workforce, you're reducing your costs and your outlays in future years. So what's happening is here they're predicting 3 and 4 or 5 years out that they're going to be in difficult circumstances, and they're making some early tough choices. So that's the piece there. I want to then step back for just a second and put this on a little bit broader context, because one of the things that was ignored for the most part during the boom period was that some of the challenges facing cities now have actually been around for a much longer period of time and were masked, in essence, by the boom itself. There are a set of underlying challenges that have been ongoing for some time that make some of this worse and make some of what we, in terms of the out years, a little more difficult to deal with. And I want to highlight three trends there quickly. One of them is simply that we have been in a long-term, multiple-decade situation where our economic wealth, our sources of wealth in this country, and our tax systems are moving in separate directions, where we've moved out of a goods-based economy, and a goods-based tax system, to a services and knowledge-based economy, and we're still using that goods-based tax system. And so we've been eroding those existing sources of revenue regardless of the current period of downturn. A second trend is the demographic forces that Steve and others have mentioned here. There are lots of things that could be said there, but the piece everybody seems most concerned about at this point is the coming baby boomer generation retirement, the effect on healthcare costs and pension costs, and those are going to be significant for local governments. Their costs they mostly can't keep up with. Their revenues aren't going to keep up with the rising costs in those areas. And the third piece, maybe the most important piece for those of us here in Washington today, is the piece that Don highlighted already, and that is that we have essentially unraveled the intergovernmental partnership in this country for a long period of time. And so in order to respond to some of these challenges, a new intergovernmental partnership, a new federal-local partnership, a new state and local partnership, new partnerships at horizontal levels are needed in order to govern differently. We've essentially let this relationship go for more than 20 years. It's time to meet each other in the middle again. It's time to build some bridges to the other side, in essence. And we have mayors and federal officials here with us today, and hopefully we're taking a step in that direction so that we govern differently and perhaps can figure out a response here in Washington that will be helpful. So thank you for your time.
So those were two really superb presentations. To sum it all up, happy days are not here yet. So what we're now going to move is really to the meat of the program. And we've got a bunch of mayors who've come in from around the country. And to really lead and moderate this discussion, we have Dave Wessel. Dave, as many folks in the room know, is one of the most respected journalists in the country. He is the economic editor for the Wall Street Journal. His column called The Capital really is must reading on a weekly basis, not just about the economy, but around living standards here and abroad. And he's responsible for overseeing coverage of the Fed and the Journal's daily coverage of the macroeconomy, global trade, and economic trends. He's shared in winning two Pulitzer Prizes. He's got a recent book out. You didn't know I was going to show the book. But a recent book, In Fed We Trust, Ben Bernanke's War on the Great Panic, and that's been covered pretty widely. So, Dave, take it from here. Thanks.
You want us east or west?
Either way, it just doesn't matter. Well, thank you very much. It's good to see so many people here. For those of you who are standing, there are a few seats here in the front, and you're welcome to come on down. We won't solicit money, maybe. So the point of this panel is to identify why anybody in their right mind, after hearing that presentation, would want to be the mayor of an American city. And this is kind of a little bit of group therapy. We thought instead of having one of them, that they would be a little comfort if we have four together. And we do have an extraordinarily broad set of cities and regions represented, actually one from each time zone. I'm going to introduce each of the mayors, and then we're going to have a conversation, and about 10:45, we're going to open it up to questions, and we'll have time for about half an hour of questions. On my immediate left is Michael Nutter, who is the mayor of Philadelphia, a job he's had since 2007. He is a graduate of the Wharton School of Business, you're going to see a trend here, and has previously worked in investment banking and brokerage firm. Next to him is Elaine Walker, who has been in Bowling Green, Kentucky for more than 15 years, and still couldn't tell us definitively why it's called Bowling Green. But she assured us that they are actually building a Bowling Green there, and not with federal stimulus funds, I might add. She's had a varied career. She worked in communication. She worked for a TV station in Los Angeles, and she's been the mayor. She's the senior mayor on this panel since 2005. Both Mayor Nutter and Mayor Walker are Democrats. Scott Smith, the next gentleman, is the mayor of Mesa, Arizona. He's a Republican. He has been mayor since 2008, previously worked for a number of firms, including a housing construction firm, and he, too, has an MBA. His is from the Arizona State University. And at the end, we have Chuck Reed, the mayor of San Jose, California, a job he has held since 2007. So you can see, if you looked at those charts, just when things started to get bad, each of these mayors took their jobs, which is another question about their sanity. But it does sort of make you realize why they don't have to worry about anybody else challenging them, given that who would want the job, given what we've been told going forward. In any event, Mayor Reed, who's a graduate of the Air Force Academy and has a law degree from Stanford Law School, was a practicing attorney in San Jose before he took the job as mayor of that city in the state of California, which we here in Washington look at as a model, because when we feel bad about how Congress functions, we just look to the California legislature and we say, it could have been worse. We're going to start by asking each of the four mayors to speak very briefly, a couple of minutes, to give us a snapshot of the economic and fiscal conditions in his or her city. And we're going to go from east to west, and we're going to start, therefore, with Mayor Nutter. We're going to go alphabetically, but I couldn't figure out four people. It's too complicated. So Mayor Nutter, give us a two-minute snapshot of the economy and fiscal condition of your city.
Dave, thank you very much. Just one point. Dave mentioned that I started in 07. I actually was elected in 07, started January 08. I know there are journalists in the audience. I don't want to get caught up at some congressional confirmation process and not have cleared up that particular issue right now.
Well, I trust you paid all your taxes. Okay, sorry.
Yes. The answer is yes.
That you can recall.
They're all paying. No one looking for me. The fiscal condition of Philadelphia is the quickest way to describe this. In September of 2008, September 11th, by a sheer coincidence, I announced that the city was facing at least a $450 million five-year plan deficit. In Philadelphia, unlike many other cities across the country, we have a financial oversight entity that requires balanced five-year plans, and each year that plan must be balanced. So it helps to ensure a certain amount of fiscal discipline. We emphasized at the time with the public the at least part. We knew this was growing, didn't know how far it was going to go. At the time, the citizens were a little stunned because, of course, we just passed the budget in May. A couple months earlier, it was balanced. Everyone seemed happy, and life was going on. You'll recall, though, if you look at any of the newspapers from that time, the following week, and over that weekend, I believe one of the major financial institutions was in the midst of a meltdown, and every day the following week, on the front page at least of our local papers, whether it was AIG, Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, Merrill Lynch, Wash Mutual, and a bunch of others, every day someone was falling apart. And so, unfortunately, the citizens began to better understand our circumstance. In the midst of all that, the Phillies were on their way to winning that World Series, and we were about to elect, for the first time, an African-American president. We, on the other hand, in city government, were trying to figure out which day do we tell the citizens that we now have a billion-dollar deficit. Do we interfere with our playoff run and World Series and parade, or do we do it right before the most historic election in most of our lifetimes? We decided to do neither. And 2 days after all the joy and excitement of President Obama being elected, I had to announce to the citizens that we had a $1 billion five-year plan deficit in the middle of the fiscal year. This has never happened in the city's history. We cut a variety of services, some layoffs, stopped 13 straight years of wage and business tax reductions in order to save money, and actually filled that hole. And then on January 15th, following year, I announced that we had a new $1 billion deficit because it continued to grow and deteriorate. And by the time I announced our budget on March 19th, we had a $1.4 billion five-year plan. And so in the course of 4 months or so, we had to solve $2.4 billion of five-year plan deficits with a variety of more cuts, more reduction of services, more layoffs, and ultimately sought a temporary increase in our sales tax going from 7% to 8%, which we needed General Assembly approval for, as well as a temporary deferral of pension payments because our pension costs continue to rise dramatically, as we've just experienced a 17% loss in value in our pension system. In the most bizarre fashion, we actually beat our benchmarks at a 17% loss. What we're trying to get to is fiscal stability, and we've still seen continued deterioration. The current fiscal year, we're down $50 million in wage tax receipts just in FY10, which we'll have to solve in the course of this fiscal year, and we're in the midst of preparing our next year's budget, which we're already anticipating a deficit for as well. Having said all of that, I do not want to pick on the gentleman, but hearing Steve's presentation, and hopefully this will not affect our bond rating by your company, but hearing your presentation this morning that the recession is over reminds me of a sign I saw one time a couple years ago that said, mission accomplished. It is not happening on the ground, and there is continued deterioration at the local level, notwithstanding every bright economist, conservative, liberal, or anything else, on the ground, we are still in the midst of declining tax revenues, figuring out how to reduce our employee costs. Pension and health care for us will be 25% of our budget in another year or so. And so the ARRA funds, which we're very excited to have, there is a little bit of a disconnect. I have no complaints, other than the fact that I can't use a dime for our budgetary challenges. And so on one day, we could announce at 10 o'clock in the morning a new grant opportunity from the federal government, and later that afternoon announce more layoffs and service cutbacks. The public is confused as to what in the world is going on. And that is a major challenge for us. Last point. Banks, investment banking firms, auto, all too big to fail. Cities and metro areas, all too important to fail. We cannot and we will not go out of business. We are a service organization. We have obligations and responsibilities that I would suggest are far greater and at least as equally, if not more important, than anything else that's going on in terms of business and industry. We provide desperately needed services and drive the economic engines in our cities and metropolitan areas unlike any other industry in the United States of America.
Thank you. Mayor Wilker?
Well, first of all, thank you for allowing me to be here because you're hearing from the big guys, and then they've invited me to represent smaller cities. I'm from the city of Bowling Green, Kentucky, home of the Corvette. We have about 55,000 people here. And also, Kentucky is the third largest state in terms of automotive industry. The good news for our state is that we are the only state where all four OEMs have been maintained, and so we still are continuing on with the Corvette. The good news is we've kept the Corvette. The bad news is that in the first 8 months of this year, they've been furloughed more than they've actually worked, which has a direct impact on our revenue source, our major revenue source, which is occupational license tax. Our property tax is a much smaller percentage. Occupational license tax is about 67% of our general fund. And so,
just explain what an occupational license tax is.
Basically what it is, instead of an income tax, we take 1.85% immediately off of every dollar that's paid to a person who works in the city. So there's no filing of any kind of a form. It just is automatically paid. And I was looking at Steve's figures, and the only revenue source that is up, which is sales tax, has no impact on my city. So that's the good news, bad news. We have about 5,000 people employed in our region in the automotive industry, and so we have seen a reduction. For us, it's been about 10% cut in our general fund revenue. And when you look at some of the brighter sides, we do have Western Kentucky University, which has grown in this period, and so that's helped temper some of the cuts. We also are the home of a major medical center that supports our region, and so that has also allowed us to stabilize somewhat in terms of our revenue sources. But we've got other pressures as well. You talk about the state. Not only does the state tend to siphon off most of what comes in from the federal government, but they also have done things like we are required to be part of a state employee retirement system. The state doesn't make their payments, but they fine local governments $5,000 a day if you don't make your payments. And so cities and counties are maintaining the limited health of our state employee retirement system. We've got a telecommunications tax. The state says, we're going to collect it for you, but we'll hold you harmless. We're losing $140,000 each year because they miscalculated. And so all of these things have caused us to not necessarily lay off, but we have consolidated positions. We have basically cut or reduced our employee workforce by 7%, and clearly we're going to have to be a little bit more creative in the future. I'm an optimist by nature, and so despite the first 30 minutes of extremely devastating information, I think that these problems also provide us with opportunities, and we have to have a paradigm shift, and it really cannot be just with local government, state government, and federal government. We've got to engage the public. We've got to engage more of the private sector. What we're doing is we're looking at public-private partnership. We want businesses to step forward and help us create those access roads to their business. We're not going to buy the property anymore, and we're not going to pay you for it, and you're going to pay for it, and you're going to relocate utilities. The other thing that we've got to do is to engage the public. We don't have the money to create new roads or expand our roads. But if they modify their driving habits, we can do much more by modifying driving habits than we can by spending $500 million in terms of an investment in our roads. So we're going to have to engage the public. We're going to have to become more actively involved in the state level and more actively involved in the federal level. And we've got to be more creative. We have a tendency to do that because we can't pull from any lower source, and we can't manufacture money, and we can't send the buck upstream, and so we are more creative.
Thank you. Mayor Scott? Mayor Smith, I'm sorry.
That's okay. I'm called Mayor Scott more than I am Mayor Smith this time. My first name is really Mayor, so that's okay. Mesa, Arizona is probably the biggest city you've never heard of. We are in the Phoenix metropolitan area. We're actually the 38th largest city in the country, a little over 465,000 people. We are actually the community for which the term boomburb was invented, because we're a very large city that lives in the shadow of the city of Phoenix, among several other large cities. And in Mesa, our biggest challenge is that growth has been our biggest industry. We have grown at a tremendous, tremendous rate. When I graduated from high school 35 years ago, Mesa was a town of 74,000 people, now 464,000 people. You can imagine the challenges we have. The other thing is that until just literally this last month, Mesa was the largest city in America without a property tax. So we relied completely on sales tax, on state shared revenue, and in Arizona, the state also does not levy a property tax. Their revenues are primarily sales tax and income tax, and then on earnings from our enterprises, our water company, our wastewater, and things like that. So it's split about a third, a third, a third. Obviously, two-thirds of those industries, people still use water and they still have garbage. Those have held fairly steady. But our sales tax and state shared revenue have gone in the drain. I took office in June of last year with a 3 or 4 year plan to change the way Mesa City government did business. That was my campaign. And I actually meant to actually live up to my campaign things.
How's that working out for you?
Actually, thanks for the setup, Mayor. The first week in July, I sat down with our city manager, Chris Brady, and we looked at a sales tax report that showed almost an 18% drop year over year in sales taxes. The three-year plan suddenly became a three-month plan. Mm-hmm. And we realized that we could not continue on doing business the way that we had. We, in essence, bought short on the economy. We rather than look at this as a temporary blip, we decided that we were going to approach this problem as basically a change in our reality. And that was the saying that we came up with. Our reality has changed. The second thing we did is that we eliminated a few words from our vocabulary. The first word we eliminated was the word cuts, because we felt that to say cuts really defied what we were saying as far as changing our reality. A cut is, in essence, a temporary reaction. We needed to change things. And so we went back to our department heads and set goals and set benchmarks that related to reducing the resources that were available, nice way of saying cuts, but maintaining service levels. In other words, we wanted to challenge our department heads to, in essence, change the way they did business. And we ended up over the next 3 months eliminating departments, consolidating departments, reforming, reinstituting, revising the way that we provided services. Nothing was off the table. We looked at some of the changes that Chris talked about in that our economy has changed. Well, also the nature of city government has changed. Our fire departments, for example, in Arizona, our fire departments, as they do in many parts of the country, provide medical services, emergency medical services. In fact, in the city of Mesa, over 70% of our annual calls to our fire department are medical related. So we're sending out a $750,000 fire truck with four highly trained professionals to wrap somebody's sprained ankle as well as save their life if they're in an auto accident. And that model, we decided, cannot continue. We sat down with our unions and worked out a way to try something different in the service delivery, in our fire, for example. Our police went to several different methods that they changed in providing services. We decided we simply cannot continue to go about business the same way we have because the world had changed. We treat this financial crisis as not being something we're going to get out of. We think that this may be as significant as the last great crisis, you know, the Depression, in that it changes not only how governments operate, but it may change the relationship between local governments, state government, and even the federal government. We've seen that already with our state government. Our relationship with our state government, with our revenue sharing, has changed dramatically. We don't know if it'll ever go back to the way it was 2, 3, 4, 5 years ago. So in Mesa, that's how we looked at it. Growth has been our industry. Obviously, with the housing boom, we did very well. With the housing crash, we suffered. But we also have things that are basic and that go beyond. Mesa is the home of the Apache attack helicopter. Boeing has a very large helicopter manufacturing plant there. And of another helicopter, the one you see without the rotor, MD helicopters. We have tourism, which is hurt, but we have other industries that have remained strong. But the overall stress and pressure that the reduction in sales tax, which is not getting any better. As a matter of fact, once again, our city manager got up and said, we hope this year would be as bad as last year. And it hasn't. Last month, 17% year over year, meaning that in the last 2 years, we are down in month over month almost 35% in the portion of our budget that provides literally one-third of our income. So we have huge challenges. The good news is that while we are looking at a 16 to 17% 18-month change or budget shortfall, the restructuring that we implemented actually created greater savings than our budgets anticipated. It does prove that you can provide services for less money in a more efficient manner. I'll give you one great example to conclude. Our libraries, we cut hours dramatically. The libraries in Mesa are literally closed 3 days a week. The other 4 days, they operate on shortened hours. Over the last year, through efficiencies, through better use of technology, we actually moved more books out of our libraries and served more citizens on fewer personnel with a 30% reduction in resources available, moved more books and served more citizens than we had the previous year. We found that it can be done, but we're wondering how much more can we go to the well. The well is getting pretty dry.
Thank you. Mayor Reed, who has the dubious honor of having the city on this panel that has the highest unemployment rate at over 13%, and told me earlier that he took office and they were already 5 years into a financial crisis in San Jose. So how bad is it out there?
It's pretty bad. Let me tell you a little bit about San Jose. We're the 10th largest city in the country, the third largest in California after Los Angeles and San Diego. And I love to brag about being the capital of Silicon Valley, the innovation center of the world, because our economy is driven by innovation in the tech sector. We are a city with no ethnic majority, and 40% of our people are foreign-born. Our economy is driven by technology, wave after wave after wave of innovation, from silicon chips that gave us our name to microprocessors to computers to the internet to information technology, bioscience, and now clean tech, which I'll come back to in a minute. The other part about our economy that makes it a little bit different is how global we are, because our tech sector companies typically have huge overseas sales, and many of the companies have more revenues from overseas than they do from the U.S. market. So that sometimes helps and sometimes hurts, depends on what's happening in the international markets. We are in the ninth year now of a long-term structural budget deficit problem. So this recession is nothing new. It just makes the misery worse and knocks us back a few notches from the progress that we had made on resolving our long-term structural budget deficit since I came into office. The good news is we are we're on a wave of clean tech, alternative energy, solar in particular, energy conservation. So we have a new sector in our economy that is growing. We still have companies that are hiring. We have companies who are making profits. And it is my hope and my drive as mayor is to ensure that those clean tech companies, as they create jobs, that they stay in San Jose and grow in San Jose. I have no doubt that we're going to create a lot of jobs. The tech sector will do that. Clean technology will create those jobs. The questions are, will those jobs stay in San Jose? Will those jobs stay in California? Will those jobs stay in the United States? It's a global economy, global market. And our companies that are creating the technology for energy efficiency and smart grid and alternative energy sources are going to create jobs. But they can put those jobs in China, the Philippines, Malaysia, Europe, or they could put them in the U.S. And they make those decisions day in and day out. So we are dependent in many ways upon the federal government. My prayer is they just don't make it worse. So we're not looking for a lot of help from the federal government, but there are areas which could be very important because our economy continued to grow well into 2008 until the wonderful days of September 2008 when the capital markets crashed and lots of projects came to a halt at that time. We were still adding jobs well into 2008, but since September we've lost jobs, so we've lost 50,000 jobs in the last year in San Jose because our clean tech sector is not growing nearly fast enough to compensate for the other jobs that are being lost. So that's the tale of our economy. We have been doing everything on the list that you saw earlier that cities are doing. All of the above is what we've been doing over the years to try to deal with the problems. And one interesting thing about dealing with those problems that I found from other mayors across the country is that we're all problem solvers, and there's no shortage of problems for us to solve, which is a good thing. But when we solve the problem, sometimes we do it in a way that the people don't fully appreciate it because we try to lessen the impact on our people. When we're making cuts in services, try to spread it out, lessen it so it doesn't go to the core services, doesn't go to what's most important. So this last year, we covered a budget shortfall of $90 million, roughly 10% of our general fund, and we only laid off a couple of dozen people. So a lot of people think, well, what was the big deal? You had this big crisis, but you didn't lay anybody off. Well, we shrink by attrition. So we're down 800 jobs from a high of about 7,400 in 2001. We're down to 6,600 jobs now, shrinking by attrition and occasionally laying people off. And the people, by and large, still don't, I think, accept the realities of things have changed, especially at local government and local government finance. The mayors know it, but it hasn't sunk in with our people yet.
Yeah. Thank you very much. There's a lot to talk about there. Rahm Emanuel famously said about a year ago that a crisis is a terrible thing to waste. You all have basically a spending side and a revenue side. And let's start with the spending side. Mayor Smith mentioned some things that they had done in Mesa that, as a result of the crisis to change the way they practice government. And I wondered if the other three of you could describe a little bit what are you doing on the spending side of your ledger? We'll get to revenues in a minute. It's different than just turning the notch another 10 cents down.
Well, I mean, we've been forced. I mean, running a city, as I described the other day to some local press, I mean, this is the toughest job at the worst possible time. You have to meet the payroll, you have to meet budgets, and citizens want service. And as the mayor said, I mean, sometimes, you know, unfortunately, they just kind of don't get it. We've reduced the size of our city government by 3,000 positions, a combination of full-time and part-time and contractor positions. Yet, local media, from time to time, when they want to know, well, how many people actually lost their job? Well, you just lay off another 2,000 people. Governments are very labor-intensive. It takes bodies, it takes individuals to make the place work. And so we left a number of positions vacant but budgeted, moved people in. I mean, as the chart indicated, I mean, if the country's going to, you know, 11% unemployment, it's at 10.2 now. We're at 11.1. So first, why would I contribute to my own problem by just summarily laying off a bunch of folks? Second is, which services would you like me to cut? Maybe should we close our records department? Should we close down the department that inspects buildings? No one wants me to lay off a police officer or a firefighter.
So where have you managed to cut spending?
We've cut spending actually in we've told every department you have to find some cut. So there are some things we don't do.
Like what?
For instance, in the streets department. We cut out residential street cleaning. Just stopped it. Philadelphia has, you know, hundreds of thousands of trees. We used to pick up people's leaves. We don't do that anymore. The Recreation Department, last summer, unfortunately, we have 76 swimming pools in Philadelphia with the most per capita of any city in the country. We only opened 40 of them. the thought that we just destroyed, kids' lives in the course of summer. But we strategically placed them or reopened them all over the place, did some fundraising, mm-hmm. public-private partnerships, as you talked about. We raised $500,000 mm-hmm. To keep swimming pools open. So it forces innovation. Cities are really all about innovation because we have to figure out how do you still provide the bulk of these services, but, rounding up tires and all kinds of things that we do. We told anyone you want to have a parade, a big celebration, you have to pay for those services now. We've been giving them away, thousands, hundreds of thousands of dollars in services. We now said, you want to have a parade? Love it. You can have all the parade you can afford. it can be 5 miles, it can be 5 blocks. Here are the number of people that we need to support that. This is what it costs. Build it into your budget.
Thank you. I should have noted that although these cities are extraordinarily different in both where they are in their economy and where they get their revenue from, in each of these four cities, the mayor does not control the school system. So when you saw that line about the aid to local cities that went from the federal government to schools, it didn't actually come to the parts of the business that these individuals control. Mayor Walker, so what have you done that's different in order to save money in your city?
Well, clearly consolidation has been critical for us, and interestingly enough, we've done more of the position consolidation at the higher level. So department heads leave, and we have one department head taking over two departments. We've tried to do little things like, for example, we haven't purchased any new vehicles except for police and fire trucks and public works equipment since 2005, and so we made sure that our public works maintenance department was authorized to service vehicles, and we're actually providing servicing of vehicles for the county, for the school system, for our transit system. Some of those little things are helping us get through, but clearly the consolidation, making do with less, capital improvements have been cut. We were building sidewalks to the tune of $1 million a year. We're not doing that anymore. We're again looking at bringing the private sector in to say, okay, you want this to happen, you're going to have to come up with the money. And we had a situation where we were going to build a road, and we still had a mentality of a private property owner whose attorney came in and said, we want you to pay us X number of dollars, and knowing that that property value was going to increase dramatically. We cut that off of our – we had the money to build it. We could have created a frontage property for this gentleman, and we said, it's off the books. Mm. We are not going to be held hostage anymore. And so we're just doing some basic changes and then trying to be a little bit more
clear. Mayor Reed?
The crisis has made some things unavoidable that we were never able to seriously consider in the past, despite our many years of dealing with our structural budget deficit. And that is the city council recently authorized the staff to negotiate for 5% reductions in the cost per employee in order to save money. We don't care if it comes out of salary, benefits, whatever, 5% across the board. We've got to negotiate with our 10 unions to do that. But the council has said we need to do this. The second thing the council did at the same time was to direct the staff to attempt to negotiate a second tier for retirement. So retirement benefits and health care for retirees have gone up dramatically in the last few years, and we're getting ready this next fiscal year to write a really big check, and a check the next year and the next year and the next year after that to cover the loss in market value in our pension plans. Mm-hmm. We've got to make that up because we have one of those wonderful, if you've got them, defined benefit plans for all of our employees. Right. We guarantee the performance, and so we got to write the big checks, we the taxpayers. So that's made it possible. The crisis has driven us to seek another way. So that's the interesting thing about it. I don't know if that's particularly different or innovative or creative. It's just the only thing you can do.
Right. Well, let me pick up on that. So I work in the newspaper industry, which is somewhere between the worst of these cities and the ones worse than that. I have never in my career, I'm 55 years old, had a defined benefit pension plan. My pay has been frozen, my bonus has been cut, and the cost of my health insurance is going up. I pay income taxes, property taxes, and sales taxes to the District of Columbia. What To how much longer can you pay municipal employees' pensions, which I know your predecessors promised, not, it wasn't on your watch, and health benefits that are somehow protected from what's going on in the private sector tax-paying lives of the people who vote for you?
Well, the first thing I did last year, in the first part of this crisis, the first thing I did was cut my own pay. I took a 10% pay cut, cut the salaries of all of my cabinet 5%, and all of us took five furlough days last fiscal year and the current fiscal year, everyone down to the level who's an exempt employee, not union, because I can't directly control their pay, everyone down to the level of $50,000 or more was going to have some impact. We then, we have four unions. I cannot imagine 10. We have four unions. We have a hybrid defined benefit, defined contribution plan on the table. We're in contract negotiations right now. We're asking the employees, we want all new employees to go into the defined contribution plan. We want all employees to pay more into the pension fund. We want them to pay more for their health care. And we have four zeros on the table right now in terms of raises for these contracts. We have step and longevity increases. All the contracts expire June 30. We're not required to maintain that. I cease them. No one got a bonus after November's announcement. So over time, I mean, these pension changes, if you talk to the actuary, you'll generate a little bit of savings now. This is for the long term. Our pension system is now less than 50% funded. I have more retirees than I have current employees. So 33,000 retirees, that's a guaranteed benefit to them. We've made that commitment. We've already bought that. And 27,000 total in the current workforce, and they're expecting one. Mm-hmm. So change has to come, and this moment mm-hmm. of crisis, I think, is going to force it.
Mayor Walker, do you have unions?
We do not have any unions. However, we are required, for example, with the retirement system, the state passed a law in 1988 saying that if a local government provided any kind of retirement system, they had to become part of the state system. KERS, Kentucky Employee Retirement System, the County Employee Retirement System covers cities and counties. The difficulty is that it's a Cadillac plan because, of course, at that time, municipal workers were saying, well, you know, we really don't get paid as much as the private sector, and so we're going to give you the benefit of better benefits. We have absolutely no seat at the table in terms of how the benefits are handled and how the entire fund is handled. And as I mentioned earlier, we must pay into that system. Mm-hmm. The state has had a shortfall. So we're working with the state to try and get that changed. We've had some modification as we go forward, but we still have a system where employees can retire after 20 years or even buy a couple of years earlier. Mm-hmm. Our hazardous duty is coming close to 47% of the cost of hiring an employee with a retirement. Now, what we did at the local level is we said, first of all, we are going to require all employees to make contributions to your health insurance. We also determined 2 years ago that we were going to put a cap on what the city paid into the system, and we had our employees develop a group that actually managed our health care system. So whether it was through increased employee contributions or reduced level of services, we are going to cap what we contribute just at a cost of living increase. Mm-hmm. So those are some of the things that we've been doing, and then, you know, cutting our...
I think this raises a much even more basic question. And we've talked about reductions in services. We've talked about the history of municipal employees. And I really think what we are faced with is something that was discussed in ideological and political, which is, what is the proper role of government? Mm-hmm. I hate that saying, but we're dealing with that every day. And not only is what the proper, what can we do? If you look at the history of cities and towns, they were not generally incorporated or formed to provide police and fire service. You know, we put together, and a lot of cities and towns across the country don't provide their own police and fire services. We came together as communities to build libraries and to build parks and to zone and to control. And then a lot of times police and fire came later. Well, the modern city basically exists for police and fire, for public safety. And so as we go through these budgetary problems, now this has taken on the primary role. In most cities, it's anywhere from 65 to 75% of the budget. The question is, what now is the role of the city? Are we simply a police and fire department? Because, for example, in Mesa, our budget deficit was so large that if we had left public safety alone, we literally would have to have wiped out every other department in our city, shut down every park, every library, everything, and we still couldn't have made up the deficit.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a basic
So you cut police and fire?
I'm sorry, what?
You cut police and fire.
We absolutely reduced police and fire. As a matter of fact, our police department took the largest because it was the largest budget. So on a pure dollar amount, it was by far the biggest cut. But it raises a question as to what kind of cities do our citizens want?
Mm-hmm. Right.
The days of knowing you're going to have 76 pools, I believe, may be over.
Oh,
the days of having your streets swept, is that something that the city government is going to be a kind of service which was expected and we've gotten used to and what we actually form cities for? That's really a challenge, and what are our citizens going to decide?
I think that's an excellent point. Doug Elmendorf, the director of the Congressional Budget Office, the other day sort of encapsulated the federal budget difficulty in, I think, a very compelling sentence, which I can't remember verbatim, but it went something like, people in the United States have decided to demand from the federal government a certain level of services and benefits, particularly older Americans, that is costs more than the amount of tax revenue they've been willing to send to Washington. Maybe I can start with Mayor Reed. If you look ahead, we saw on those charts something. We saw revenues rose in the earlier years, and spending went right up with them. And now revenues have fallen, and obviously spending is going to fall. Nothing we've heard this morning leads me to believe that the recession for municipal finance is anywhere near over. Do the people of your city understand that you are going to have to give them something less over the next 3 or 4 years than they're getting now? Or have you protected them from that harsh reality the way parents protect their kids from?
The people in San Jose understand it because I've been preaching it for a long time since I came into office. I declared the budget deficit public enemy number one. Because the way it works, if you project it out far enough, the city of San Jose will have one employee. It'll be very well paid. But when your expenses are going up faster than revenues.
Very busy, too.
No, I predict it'll be a fire department battalion chief on overtime. But, that's just inescapable. It is unsustainable. It can't be fixed. And there's other problems at work as well, just beyond this recession and our structural budget deficit, because the revenue sources that we depend upon. In San Jose, we have the top three revenue sources are property taxes, sales taxes, and a utility tax. Those three combined are just barely enough to pay our public safety budget. So we got another 100 revenue sources that we put together to pay for all those parks and libraries and streets and things like that. But if you look at sales taxes, you've already heard a little bit about sales tax. Not only are we shifting from a goods economy to a service economy, we're not getting the sales taxes off the goods that are sold on the internet. We're supposed to. We got a use tax in California. Nobody pays it. So we're not collecting the sales tax. It's not going to grow at the rate of the economy. Property taxes are not going to grow at the rate of the economy. Utility taxes, well, we're trying to conserve energy, conserve water. So that's not going to grow at the rate of the economy either. We have a couple other taxes. So we have a dump fee that's very a good source of revenue because lots of cities dump at our landfills. We're going to be a zero-waste city. Right now we already recycle 63%. We're going to 100% recycling. What happens to the dump fee? Well, it goes to zero. So that's counter to good fiscal health throughout in the future. So that trend is continuing, and that is a very long-term problem for all cities.
Mayor Walker, do the people in your town expect less services in the future?
Absolutely not. I think that there is an expectation that somehow we can still cover those services. They want their leaves picked up. They want their streets swept. They want to make sure that the police and fire are there when they're needed. I think that we have, in large part, created our own problem in that we're going to solve the problem. You know, don't worry about it. We'll take care of it. We will make modifications. And I think that now we have to say, okay, we are in this together. And if you want to see us get through it, you're going to have to be part of the, you're not just part of the problem, you're part of the solution.
Mm-hmm. Renata?
I think the citizens have heard it so many times from me that, I mean, I think they kind of get it, but as the mayor indicated, but they don't like it. And so You know, unlike state government, unlike federal government, I mean, we see our folks in the supermarket, at the movies, at walking down the street. I mean, we're not in these faraway places of state capitals in the federal government. So, I mean, you have to kind of deal with them right there at the moment. But as the mayor asked the question about what's the proper role of cities, and I know you're the moderator, but, I mean, what's the proper role of the federal government?
Mm-hmm. I'm getting
all
to that.
This? And, I mean, that, and by posing that question or even raising it, I'm not saying that the government should give us money at all. But there are things that they can do to be helpful and supportive, as, again, they have been with any number of other industries. And so I think the citizens, again, I mean, the citizens of Philadelphia know that I did not create the economic crisis and meltdown of the financial systems in the country and in the world. I mean, I was minding my business, picking up trash, filling potholes, and then the budget director came in one day and said, we have no money. Okay. So they expect us to do certain things. They're not happy about what we're doing. Everyone is mad about something. But they're still trying to figure out, okay, we're paying more in taxes temporarily. We're getting less service. What are all these other folks doing? The state is cutting its budget, which has a negative impact on us. And then they hear about billions of dollars. I mean, the Fed's only talking billions. I mean, it's like
we're
first
up to trillions
out
now. We're, billions are passe. We're trillions.
Trillions.
Now.
Oh, okay. All right. You know, like I'd take 1% of a trillion and we'd just call it a day. So yeah, so they're trying to figure out, okay, so what's the federal government doing?
All right. Well, let's go to that. So the president feels your pain, and he talked Congress into $787 billion worth of stimulus. And when the administration talks about it, there was a chunk for this, a chunk for that, and a big chunk for state and local government. They say it really quick together. So I wonder if each of you would tell us, has the stimulus made any difference in your local budget? Do you want to start, Mr. Smith?
Well, I guess I'm starting whether I want to or not.
No, you don't have to.
No.
I don't recall. You sense me as the kind of guy that anybody asked you to speak, you ever said
that's
no.
True.
So I thought I was safe.
They have asked me to quit speaking many times, though. You know, I guess it depends on what you say. Has it made a difference? I think on the fringes, yes. You know, we've been able to accelerate some projects that we wouldn't have. Wouldn't be able to build a park and ride that we maybe not have built. Maybe we shouldn't have built. I don't know, but the stimulus monies were there. But generally, I would say at the city level, from a day-to-day operation, the fill in the potholes, no, we have not felt it. Because that's not what the program is set up to do.
Right.
You know, to say that cities have benefited from the stimulus, you have to say, what does it mean to be benefited? Yeah, we've got something new.
Well, like, talk about the COPS program. Did you get any?
Well, the COPS program is great for Mesa because we'll have 25 additional police officers on the streets through a stimulus through the COPS. That's very limited in scope. We pay the first 3 years. The federal government picks up the fourth year. We're grateful for that because it enables us to basically stop the bleeding as it relates to
you
public
pay
safety.
The first 3 years and they pay the other way around, right?
No, other way around. Flip-flop. Thank you, everybody, for noticing that. They pay the first 3 years. We pay the fourth year.
Right. And did that limit the number of COPS you could hire, that fact?
Well, we have to go through the normal process, and those COPS will almost take 2 years before they literally get on the street.
Uh-huh.
Because by the time you go through the hiring process, then the training process, then the replacement process, you're 2 years down the road. The other thing is it creates sort of dilemmas, because our city council really struggled with the idea that, gee, this is great to have the federal government pay for 3 years of 25 police officers. How are we going to pay for the fourth year?
Right.
You know, we got another thing through the stimulus, assistance with two new fire stations in areas that are really growing quickly, and the response times are off the charts. Those buildings are going to look nice. We struggle with how do we put firefighters in there? How do we put equipment? So on a day-to-day basis, it's been a real struggle.
Right. Mayor Reed, stimulus trickled down to you yet?
It's been a very minimal impact. We've only received and spent about 10% of what we expect.
Right.
There's this huge lag time in getting the money and spending the money.
Yeah.
But when you think about the impact on our economy, the federal stimulus is a very small drop. The Silicon Valley economy, and as the capital of Silicon Valley, we're part of it, but it's really 40 cities spread across four counties. And if you look at all the aggregate federal stimulus money that will come directly to the cities, it's probably about $300 million over 2 years. Our local economy is 2% of the national GDP. And if you drop $300 million into a $300 billion economy, it's not all that noticeable, especially when you spread it out over 2 years. We love the money. We'll take the money. It's allowing us to do projects. It's putting people to work. It's keeping people at work. And those are all good things. But in terms of stimulating the economy, I don't see it. It's not a jobs program in the sense that I would say that you would do if you're trying to create jobs and long-term jobs.
But if you've saved a job, is someone not laid off because of stimulus or not?
No.
No?
No, the stimulus money is going for special things, which we appreciate, but it's not something that comes into our general fund. It helps us deal with our problem.
Mayor Walker?
Every dollar that's come into our local government from the stimulus fund has gotten into the economy. The Housing Authority is putting new roofs on their units and new energy-efficient windows. The local transit authority has ordered buses, and those are on the way. We've gotten some CDBG funds that we're using, for example, in small business development.
Community development block grant.
Exactly. And we just got notification that our energy efficiency block grants have come through, and that's going to get, as soon as we get the money, that will get into the pipeline, including small grants and some larger project grants. The difficulty is that it's kind of this huge amount of revenue coming in, and when we actually put the hose on, whatever trickles out at the local level has done great things. Somehow the state manages to take a lot of it to balance their budget. So we are very happy with what we've gotten. It just has a lot less than promised.
Love the COPS program, advocated for it, and the changes. We're going to get 50 police officers. We can only use our COPS money when we get back to a base line of strength. And unfortunately, since we had to delay a class to save money, again, another one of the things we did, we can't use our COPS money yet until we get our number up to a certain level, and then we can use it. I'll give you a few numbers. We applied for, I believe, $310 million in ARRA funds. We've been awarded $157 million in funding. Cash on hand, about $14 million. It's, again, one of these wonderful situations. The feds, as the mayor said, love ARRA, not saying a bad thing about it, keep it coming. But there is a difference in our world between award and receipt. They love awards. Big press release, big announcements, big letters. I have a lot of letters that add up to about $157 million. In my treasury is about 14. So just kind of getting it out, getting it and kicking it back out the door. So excited about the program. But as the mayor said, on pure jobs, I mean, if you were going to really put money out there, it's summer jobs for young people. It is a little bit of kind of some WPA. I mean, if I could walk out on a street corner and say, you five guys, you want to work? Got a job for you. I got some parks. I've got some media strips. I got all kinds of stuff that need to be taken care of. You want to work today? Here's a job for you, and it's going to be around for a little bit. We have people, 24 guys just graduated from a solar panel installation program. I went to their graduation. Almost all of them now have jobs in the private sector, not in the public sector. So, I mean, people are getting trained. These programs in solar and weatherization, 2 to 8 weeks. I mean, it's not some long, drawn-out program. And there are jobs out there in the green economy for folks. But, you know, as Tom Cochran says, everyone's not going to jump on a backhoe.
Right.
And everyone doesn't want to be up on a roof installing solar panels. So, I mean, you've got to have a little bit of something for a wider range of
folks.
To add on to what Mayor Nutter said, you know, if we look at a stimulus to create jobs, then one thing the cities and towns, and to go on what Mayor Walker said, emphasize is that the cities are where things are happening. 80 to 85% of the economic activity in this country are generated within cities and towns. And it would seem like if we're going to pump the economy, create jobs, that we should go also for something that creates the greatest long-term return on our investment. And we're not seeing that because if you put money where the real economic activity is, it'll have the longest-term benefit, and we're just not seeing that. The cities are not getting a proportionate share, which means the economic activity is not getting the investment that would create long-term growth.
All right, so I sense a kind of general pattern here that cuts across all four of you is a bit of frustration at your relationship with the state government, which is traditionally a major source of revenue to the local governments. Mayor Reed, it must be quite a challenge. Can you talk a little bit about what it's been like to deal with the state legislature and the state government budget in California and how that makes your job easier?
Well, I have been quoted a few times saying the state of California is ungovernable. I think there's plenty of evidence to support that that position. And one of the things that I've discovered, we talk about revenue sharing. Mm-hmm. In California, it's a two-way street. So when the state got in trouble, it came to us. And unfortunately, we do have a sales tax that goes through Sacramento. We have a property tax that goes through Sacramento. We have other revenue sources that go through Sacramento. And when the state legislature ran a few billion dollars short again, they took local revenues all across the state. And so we've taken a hit. And I know that when they get back into session again, they'll be looking at our highway users tax, which is another category they didn't take last time. So it's a huge burden on the local governments for that. In that respect, but it's also a burden on our economy, the innovation economy and the technology. We're generating jobs because the state is a drag on the companies when they're making a decision about where to put that next factory, where to make that next investment. They're looking at the state of California saying, you know, I'm not too sure this state is governable. I'm not too sure about the future. And so that's another big negative on that column when they're evaluating the creation of jobs because they're going to create the jobs. Will it be in California? Well, I hope so, but we have our problems.
What's it like in Arizona?
Well, Arizona, we're having a contest with California to see which state government is the most dysfunctional. And the cities, unfortunately, are in, I think, their third lawsuit against the state legislature because it seems like in times of real budget difficulty, things like the state constitution become minor irritations to state. And you're experiencing the same thing in California. Our state government has about a $10 billion budget for this year and a $3 billion shortfall for fiscal 2009-2010 that they're trying to fix. They've done the same things that they have in California. It's been a more of an upflow than a downflow with revenues, and it's a challenge. The unfortunate thing is it's really ruined in many ways the relationship. You know, cities are really, you know, children of the state. We were creation of the state, right. Something which our state legislators constantly remind us. Yes. On the other hand, cities like to believe, as I said before, this is where things are happening. You know, we're really missing out because it's this constant fight. And I think that's been the real unfortunate thing, certainly in Arizona, and I know in California, is that our relationship between cities and states has been damaged and irreparably damaged in many ways.
Mm-hmm. And in Kentucky?
Well, I think the biggest thing for Kentucky is that the state was very happy with a large portion of its stimulus money because it helped to balance the budget. Of course, we don't have that luxury. The other thing that we have is that the state, as a parent, not only wants to decide how we can raise revenue, they definitely want to control the revenues. They want to bring it through the state before it comes to the cities, and then they, of course, siphon off a portion of that for administration. And so you're kind of caught in this difficult position of you can't raise property tax above a certain percentage. We have no revenue sharing in the state. We are limited. Cities of our size cannot have any type of sales tax or restaurant tax. So they don't want to allow us the option of increasing our revenue streams because that may be construed as actually increasing taxes. And so, you know, you've got this kind of difficult situation of trying to be creative but with one hand tied behind your back.
What about in Pennsylvania?
Fortunately, the governor is a former mayor, and we served together when I was in city council. That's on the positive side. On the negative side, it was actually Pennsylvania was the last state in the country to have a fully passed budget. We were looking at California in the early summer and said, well, you know, we'll certainly be done before then. California got finished, and we're still sitting around. The governor only got it done about a month or so ago. The state makes cuts. That trickles down to us, and it has a broader impact, especially for Philadelphia and the counties around us. We have kind of a five-county region, all very dependent on the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania. Property tax is the primary tax for the counties around us, not for us. And so when the state makes cuts, counties have to raise their taxes. When our economy starts to go south, we drag them with us. And so, I mean, I think quietly many of the federal officials, again, would admit that running the bulk of the ARA money through the states may not have been the best thing to do. I mean, you know, fifth largest state in the country. I mean, we have some counties that have more animals than they have people, but, you know, the governor's got to take care of all the family members of the General Assembly. We have the largest General Assembly in the country. So it's a challenge, it just makes you long for, some old days of, UDAGs and general revenue sharing, some targeted assistance, as the mayor said. If you really want to stimulate the economy, the feds gave a bunch of money to banks who now won't lend it to anyone because they need to hold on to it. God only knows why. I've got easily a dozen projects that seized in their tracks in the private sector and in education and medicine, which has been the lifeline for us. 30% of our population works in education, medicine, and related industries. They still want to build. They still need to grow. Education, medicine, if they don't grow, they die. You'll put people to work immediately. We're expanding our convention center. We had a dozen hotels scheduled for some kind of activity, most of which got stopped dead in their tracks because they can't borrow any money from anyone. You want to put people to work? Build something in cities. Real projects in the private sector, good to go. Everyone has an economic development agency, real bankers, real loan officers. As they talk about the states, every bridge in the city of Philadelphia actually goes somewhere.
That may make unique.
So, we don't have these kinds of issues. Our business, what we do, is on the front page of whatever the appropriate newspaper is. We have city councils.
So far.
We have press that watch us on a regular basis. You can't find 15 cents. Somebody wants you to explain it. So if they would invest in cities and understand what it is that we do, we could actually turn this country around.
Mayor Smith mentioned that they're going to have a property tax in Mesa for the first time, right? Just quickly, is anybody else finding new sources of revenue in this crisis? Are you doing anything?
We scrub it every year, and probably the new source of revenue is in fees and charges. So our planning, building, and code enforcement department is funded 100% by fees.
Fees, right.
Fee for service. We can't raise taxes in California without a vote of the people, so it's a tough proposition. We're always looking at that, but we rarely have the opportunity to put it to a vote because it's
and
not
by the way,
pass.
Our property tax was voted on by the people and approved,
right.
2-1. And,
rejected the first time, and then,
yeah.
Right. Have either of you found new sources of revenue?
No.
We utilize every source that we're allowed by the mm-hmm. state government at different levels.
All right,
temporary increase in the sales tax.
Temporary sales tax. Let me end with this one question to each of you, and then we'll turn to the audience. You are in Washington, and I know despite the fact that you all have promised not to whine, and you've done an excellent job of that.
Excellent job of whining or
no,
not
whining? No, not whining. Very quickly, if there was just one thing that the federal government could do that would make things a little easier in your locality, what would that one thing be? Do you want to start, Mary?
I'd like to see the Department of Energy loan guarantees process and out the door because I've got 10 clean tech companies that have applications into the Department of Energy. Once those are done, those companies are going to invest hundreds of millions of dollars in San Jose building factories. We need to get that done. There was a long backlog from the previous administration. They're trying to catch up. But each one of those could generate millions of dollars of private sector investment and a lot of jobs. I have one company, in particular, NanoSolar, one of our great solar companies that produces the world's most cost-effective solar cell. They have sold out their production for 4 years into the future. They would like to expand and build another factory in San Jose. They need a DOE loan guarantee to get that because there's no place to borrow money. The mm-hmm. capital markets are not open for business to ordinary companies and ordinary investments.
Okay. Mayor Smith?
To echo what Mayor Reed said, and Mayor Nutter, we'll talk about this a little bit more, it's all about capital. And I know we're not looking for a direct check from the federal government. We live and die by the economic activity within our region, within our cities. And the capital markets being closed, if the federal government can step in and either help us directly, help our businesses to open up that capital market, it creates the kind of revenue that we don't have to look at new sources. Now, there are some untapped revenues. Mayor Reed mentioned the internet tax. I think it's something we need to maybe look at again. Because as the world changes...
You mean the tax on goods sold, services sold over the
internet? Yeah, I think last year, for example, in Mesa, sales around Christmas were down at our stores. I believe I read somewhere that the internet commerce was actually up. It was the one area that actually showed an increase.
And I better fix that this year. They'll both be down.
I don't think that's going to change long term. I think that is a future. I understand when it was imposed originally that it was a fledgling industry. I think we need to revisit that because there's a lot of revenue that historically has stayed in communities that is now leaving our communities, and we're suffering. We're still having to provide the same level of services. So, but capital, we took advantage of the Build America bond program at the federal government, and it saved us $12 million in interest.
Why don't you just give the 25-cent description of what that is?
Basically, it's the federal government. It's basically a federal subsidy of that allows you to go out and float bonds. And we saved about 100 basis points on a regular bond offering. We were surprised because it was a very active bidding.
They helped you pay the interest on the bonds.
Pay the interest,
and you sold them at the taxable interest rate rather than
that's right. We sold the taxable interest rate. The government subsidized difference, and it reduced our net interest costs, which comes right out of our general fund, by $12 million. Mm-hmm. That's not a small amount, and that's just on one issuance in the city of Mesa.
Mayor Walker?
For us, the biggest thing is the block grant program. I think that it's whether it's the community development block grant, which has a long history of being an effective way to get federal revenues into the local governments. In Bowling Green, we use it for everything from transforming rental housing into home ownership. We use it to create, we've created 34 new companies in 4 years, small businesses. We have just helped to build a transitional home for children who are coming out of the mm-hmm. court system, and also the energy block grant program. Those allow the local governments to determine how we can get, not to balance our budget, but how we can get money into the local economy.
Access to capital, the same. Just the ability for our city government, if we could borrow directly from Treasury, 30-year Treasury rate, I'll give you 50 basis points on top of that, so Treasury's going to make a little bit of money. We're a good credit because we're going to pay. We would save $132 million a year for 30 years. It's right out of our general fund. So, again, not asking the federal government to give us anything. Just help us. A saved dollar is the same as a raised dollar for us. As long as we're not spending it somewhere else, $132 million a year for that length of time right on our general fund would really solve a lot of problems as opposed to borrowing at 6-7%. Out on the open market.
Okay. Let's turn to the audience. We have some microphones, a couple of rules. Wait for the mic. Say who you are. A question ends with a question mark. And we're going to try and avoid having all four mayors answer every question. So if it's particularly aimed at one of them, do so. And if not, we'll figure it out.
I never heard that.
Where's the mics? Why don't you start here on the aisle here? And then we'll go to the gentleman in the front here with the next one.
Good morning, mayors. Introduction, John Maggs from National Journal. You all have talked about doing more with less, and I'm sure you are. The question, I'd like you to look beyond your own cities for a second at the plight of cities in general. And I was struck by this chart that Mr. Haney's presentation that showed this divergence between revenues and spending in the last 3 years that's really unprecedented. Cities were spending a lot more money than they could reasonably expect to have gotten in revenues the last 3 years, and that is a big reason for this hole that you're starting out in as we embark on this kind of period of slow growth to come. And I wonder if you can reflect on why it is that you've all talked about reinventing yourselves and doing more with less. Something changed 3 years ago where cities decided that they were going to be spending a lot more than they could reasonably expect to get. There's just a huge, huge divergence there. What happened?
Someone want to take a stab at that?
I can only speak from our experience. In Arizona, we're required rather than balance our budget, we can only spend what we collect. Once again, as a sales tax generate or sales tax based budget, you only collect as many sales taxes as you bring in. We spent the boom times building our reserves, and not expanding services as much as we have. So I don't know where that comes from, because generally cities are the one level of government where there really is no plan B. We don't print money. We really can't go out and go deep into debt except for capital items. And so from an operational standpoint, I'm not quite understanding that, because every year we can only spend what we bring in.
This must be related to bonding for long-term projects. I mean, clearly that's one of the things that's important for us as a local government, is to be able to bond for our new rec center or our new fire center. So that's the only thing I can think of.
I think the question is whether your predecessors thought that the boom would last.
No, my predecessor screwed everything up. Yeah.
But you're also going to see increased spending in some areas that you don't necessarily want to spend money in, but have to. I don't want to spend more money on prisons, but I have to. They're going to be fed. They need health care. Unions get raises because people expect raises over some period of time. Our pension costs keep going up. We've had double-digit increases in our health care costs. There's virtually nothing I can do about them. So you're going to spend that money no matter what.
The gentleman here in the blue tie, can you give him the mic? And then why don't you give it to the man on the other side, right here in the blue shirt.
Right. Hi, I'm David Perry of David Kim Perry Communications here in Chevy Chase. I got a question for all the mayors. You can answer it any way you want. I'm concerned about your relationship with different mayors in China, specifically cities like in Shenzhen, out there in Chengdu and Beijing. I know President Obama was just there a couple of days ago. I'm wondering, your population, what we're talking about, what, 1.8 million in your town?
One and a half.
And you probably have about 500,000.
Not quite.
It's about the same you and about,
I got a million.
About a million there. Well, I did some research online, and I found out that Chengdu, Shenzhen, and Beijing, minimum 5 million people. And so I'm wondering, are you guys in contact with the mayor?
Does anybody want to take a stab at that?
Well, we have a sister city relationship with a city down in southeastern China that we have, you know, cultural and other things. And we are constantly looking for economic development opportunities in China, but it certainly hasn't risen to the level that I think it can. Once again, as Mayor Reed said, I think one of the things that our country as a whole has to realize is that it truly is a world economy. Now, that sounds like old news, but I can tell you that within our own business communities and everything, we are really not totally up to speed with the fact that we are losing jobs, not to California, but to China, but to Singapore, but to India, but to places like that. And so I think we need to get more in line with that.
Okay, sir.
My name is Joe Williams. I'm with the Boston Globe, and I wanted to ask you about jobs. Mayor Nutter talked about it briefly where you said you've got five guys on a corner who need work. If the federal government would provide either funding or some kind of guarantee for a project that you could fund, you could not only put guys back to work, you could also get the economy growing, you could rebuild infrastructure, et cetera. I was at an earlier seminar that talked about the need for a WPA-style approach to solve this problem, and that cities have not necessarily reaped the benefit. I mean, you guys all talked about it from the Recovery Act, that some of the money got there, not a lot of it got there, not a lot of it was creating jobs or stimulating the economy as much as balancing state budgets. I'm wondering if you guys could talk about whether or not there is a need for a WPA-style effort to get people in cities back to work, and whether the federal government needs to target that specifically at cities as opposed to just sort of sending the money out the door to states and trying to expect them to parse it out.
Yes.
Okay. Mayor Reed?
I think the key difference is the federal spending that creates a job that's based and dependent upon federal spending, and when the federal spending goes away, the job goes away.
Right.
I don't think that's what the focus ought to be on. I think the focus ought to be on spending money that creates jobs that will live on and spin off other jobs without federal government spending continuing on. And that's why I was talking about the Department of Energy loan guarantees that go into factories that create jobs, and it doesn't matter what the federal government is doing the next year because we already have the jobs. There's a lot of money in the stimulus package for training people for green-collar jobs.
Right.
We need to create those jobs so that there's some place where those folks go to work.
Mayor Walker?
And I think that the block grant program is a very effective tool to bring those jobs into the local government rather than someone else deciding what kind of a project needs to be done in a local community.
Okay, woman on the aisle there.
Hi, I'm Deborah Kimball. I'm a previous city manager of Saginaw, Michigan. So if you want to know what happens when you get beyond the tipping point, come to Michigan. We all know. My question is, you've talked a lot about vertical relationships and what could the federal and state governments. What are you doing in regards to horizontal cooperation and coordination? Because I think one of the big problems, especially for core cities, is the spread of government at the local level and how that's affected our costs.
You mean the city with their surrounding suburbs?
Yeah. Exactly, and that's what we face in Michigan.
One of the things that we've done, the one thing about the mayors, again, we share a lot of information. We steal each other's ideas, give credit, always where credit is due. So Mayor Daley in Chicago, Mayor Hickenlooper in Denver, are kind of leaders in the area of Metro Caucuses. And so I brilliantly named ours the Metropolitan Caucus. So it's Philly, Bucks, Chester, Delaware, Montgomery counties. We are applying for ARA grants as a region, first time ever, that the five of us have virtually signed anything together other than, you know, some kind of emergency management, you know, agreements, those kinds of issues. We're doing it on the energy side in terms of transportation with our local transit agency, SEPTA, as well as some regional training programs in the green economy. White House is very interested in promoting and supporting metropolitan area cooperation agreements as, again, we compete as a region. The day I came in office, I said, we're going to stop competing against each other. We're going to partner. And so it's the Philly region versus other parts of the country, other parts of the world.
And I will tell you one thing we're doing in Mesa. We're part of what's called the sub-metro area called the East Valley of Phoenix. And there's a little over 1.5 million people in the cities of Mesa, Tempe, Chandler, Gilbert. We do a lot of things together. Our police operate what's called a fusion center where they come together and do all their gang-related activities and a lot of cross-line utilization. Also, just recently, four communities got together to sign a joint ambulance contract. In Arizona, the ambulance services are provided by private companies. So four communities came together to eliminate city lines to provide a much more efficient way of providing services at a much higher level, and we were promptly sued by the ambulance companies to try and block it. So,
you must be doing something right. No good deed goes unpunished, right?
South Central Kentucky has brought together 10 counties for economic development.
Okay, one here, and then where's the other mic? Why don't you take it towards the back so we can be a little...
I'm Connor Doherty. I'm David's whipping boy at the Wall Street Journal. And given the number of fixed costs you're talking about, I guess, Mayor, not about anyone, you know, pensions, debt service, things that go on for, you know, decades, I guess, at least pensions, should people just basically expect less for more or less for the same, you know, citizens, less services? You know, meaning that sort of academically, if more of your money is going to go to a piece that people don't see, and then...
Well, that's part of the conversation. I mean, you know, part of our discussion at home is our pension and health care costs continue to rise. Now, we're either going to make some changes over there, or you're going to have less service. I mean, it's literally, it's the same pair of pants, some money in the left pocket, some money in the right pocket, but it all adds up to be the same. I want to provide more service to the citizens of Philadelphia. I believe our public employees deserve, you know, fair contracts, good benefits. But what I say is it's a fair contract that the citizens can afford. And so our goal here should be more on the service side, not dumping more money into the pension fund. We have to move from this antiquated defined benefit concept over to defined contribution.
The current model is not sustainable. Although, I think in the short run, there will be less services because that is the easiest place to take the money is to cut services, shrink by attrition, or lay people off. It is much more difficult to renegotiate the contracts with the unions. It is much more difficult to change the pension system to a second tier. Those are all terribly difficult things to do. I believe they have to be done. I believe they will be done. But that is not something that gets done in one
term.
Year or 2 years.
Is there a question? A gentleman there with the blue shirt, the highest hand in the back, right? Stand up.
John Cromarty. I work on rural development issues for the Department of Agriculture, but my question's about health care reform.
We're in favor of it.
I'd like to know what percentage of your budget is, you know, spent on providing health care for employees. You said this is a labor-intensive enterprise.
Absolutely.
And a little back-of-the-envelope calculation. What if, say, your health care costs were reduced by 50%, which would put the United States on par with comparable countries around the world? We spend twice as much now on health care as other industrialized countries. Let's say we got to where France and Japan and Switzerland and England and you name it are, and we're spending half of our, you know, half of what we spend now on health care. What would that do to your budget?
Let me just reframe that. So the first part was how much of your budget goes to health care, and I think if you could speak a little bit about what, if anything, you've been able to do to try and reduce the cost, and then to his question of if we sprinkled pixie dust on every healthcare budget and it fell by half, what would happen?
Well, I'll take a little different spin on that. I honestly don't know what percentage. Obviously, when 70% of your budget is personnel related, there's a huge percentage that goes to healthcare. But I'll tell you one thing that the cities grapple with as far as healthcare. And that is, in Mesa, Arizona, we have become the primary care physician for a large segment of our society. You know, when I was a kid, 911 didn't exist. And so when I had the sniffles or I had even an injury, my mom put me in the car and took me to the doctors. Now people pick up the phone and dial 911, and our paramedics show up in a $750,000 fire engine and provide them health care. Then they're taken to an emergency room, and whether they can pay or not, they're provided health care. And that's the greatest strain on our economy, is that we, and that's one of the expenses that Mayor Nutter's talking about, when someone dials 911, we got to show up.
Right.
And I don't care what you do. You're going to show up. Now, as far as reduction in services, what happens and what people in the cities will not recognize is that where we see the degradation of services, maybe in closing pools, that's what they recognize, that's what they understand. Mm-hmm. But in reality, our biggest threat is that 911 call gets answered in 6 minutes instead of 4 minutes.
Right.
And that's not something that's noticeable unless you're sitting there with a heart attack. But that's our greatest threat as far as healthcare, is that we are providing massive quantities of healthcare as city governments, and people don't realize the millions and millions of dollars we spend to take care of basic health needs for people.
Love to have that kind of cut. Our, as I mentioned before, pension and healthcare costs, I talk about them in a total context, 25% of the budget. If we could see a 50% reduction in healthcare costs, it would have a pretty significant impact on our budget.
Harry? We spend 75% of our general fund on people. They're the ones who deliver the services. That's what we're in. We're a service business. So out of that 75%, 70% of it goes to wages, 20% goes to retirement, and 10% goes to health care and some other benefits. So if we reduce the health care, that helps. It does not solve our problem. But the problem with both health care and retirement benefits is the rate of growth. If we look back over the last 10 years in San Jose, retirement benefits and health care benefits have gone up by more than 100%.
Right. Let's go back here, and then the guy in the blue shirt, if you can stand so they can see you.
Good morning. My name is James Jones, and I'm a recent transplant to D.C. from Boston and a hopeful contributor to the administration's efforts on social innovation and building partnerships with business and private sector and public sector. And it goes to the heart of that effort. Mayor Walker and the others mentioned the development of partnerships between the private and public sector. Where do you see there's the greatest gain in that, and how do you engage them more?
So the private sector.
Well, for example, with the Small Business Development Program, we've got the Housing Authority, which brought into the mix the Western Kentucky University Business School and this a group of minority business owners who are creating small businesses. They've created 34 small businesses in the last 4 years. You look at the transportation sector, and so again, bringing the public-private partnership in. Economic development is one where we're bringing people to the table, and people are giving up a little bit more and expecting a little bit less so that we can all realize some improvement.
Sir?
This year, the Milken Institute published a study on the tech sectors around the world. San Jose metro area is still number one by a pretty wide margin over number two, three, four, five, et cetera. But they described the reason for that as we are a unique ecosystem of collaborating entities. So the collaboration that goes on between government and the private sector, education, nonprofits, is really important to what happens in the valley in the future of our economy. So as a city, we are working directly with industry to leverage the opportunity that we have for clean technology. So we have several initiatives underway within the city and within the region to collaborate around what are the impediments, what can we do, how can we move the industry ahead, working in collaboration with the private sector in several initiatives to improve the economy.
Travis Doom, Arizona State University. So K-12 education is largely funded at the local level. So regardless of how much control you guys actually have as mayors over those, you know, I mean, your particular municipalities, what are the innovations and the sort of creation solutions that you guys are undertaking or foresee in that context of, you know, kind of reconceptualizing what are the services that you should deliver and doing it without making just, you know, kind of broad cuts?
just for our situation, I don't know about others, actually the primary funding source for public education, at least in Philadelphia, is the state, although we put about $800 million on the table ourselves from the city government and property taxes. We developed a shared services, kind of a joint shared services committee. We wanted to examine, we're the two biggest entities other than the University of Pennsylvania. We have a lot of buildings, we buy a lot of stuff, and in many instances we buy a lot of the same stuff. And so how do we maximize that level of leverage for cost savings? Our planning departments, if the school district is about to renovate or possibly build a new building, what are we building nearby? Should we be designing those together? And are we putting them in a place where there actually are people, as opposed to historically there was always a school here? Well, that's wonderful. No one lives there anymore. Why would we put a school there? Or, you know, renovate the library? Those kinds of things. So there's a lot of planning activity that goes on between the city and the school district in that kind of partnership.
Okay, the man here with the beard, and then we'll go to the woman in the front.
Hi, I'm Rick Rybeck with Just Economics. There was some talk earlier about reengineering services. You know, meet a performance measure, meet a benchmark, but find a new way, better way, cheaper way of doing it. Wondering if any of the mayors are taking the same approach with revenues. Revenues can have different impacts in terms of their incentive effects on productive activity. Donald Shoup in California wrote a book recently called The High Cost of Free Parking. And he noticed that if in certain parts of town where there's a lot of congestion, actually by charging more for parking, they get more turnover, more business revenue, more sales tax revenue. And people were going there, but they decide, well, I don't want to pay the parking fee, so I'll take transit. So, you know, you can re-engineer your taxes and fees. Wondering if you're looking at that. Maybe in a revenue-neutral way to create better incentives.
Just a quick example. We did a little bit of that for two different reasons. One was for an hour of parking in many areas of downtown Center City, Philadelphia, it cost $1. It was the cheapest parking possibly anywhere in the United States of America. We were almost giving it away. It was just stupid. So we doubled the parking rates in Center City and a couple other areas. It has actually done exactly what you said. It did reduce some congestion. It does lead to greater turnover. And a side benefit was some of the extra money actually goes to the school district of Philadelphia. So we, the city, were able to contribute more, not from our own pocket, but from another funding source. So it worked very well.
And one of the reasons why we moved to Bowling Green from Los Angeles was because they don't have any meters, any parking fees down there.
One of the things we did on our revenue side is, for example, we operate two airports in Mesa. And, you know, the way that government looks at revenue is much different than I ever looked at it when I was in the private sector. You know, government, for example, believes that, you know, you can charge whatever you want and the market will accept what you do. Right. The other thing is there is a disconnect between the consequences, as you mentioned, and what revenue you're charging. For example, at our airports, we were renting space without trying to figure out how did that fit into the overall economic development. Our revenue we look at as, you know, first of all, our basic source of revenue have to be approved by the voters. So there's nothing we can do that's short term. But the things we can affect, such as fees, such as rentals, such as things like that, we now have tied it into an overall economic model to try and create this long-term stability, recognizing that our financial strength, I believe, comes from our overall economy in our city. And so we've done little things that have created business activity. So we have started to look at revenue differently. But, you know, it's incremental because our base revenue, I got to go to the voters and get them to increase that property tax sales tax or whatever. So you can look at it at the fringes, but it's not going to solve our problem.
Why do you have two airports?
Why do we have two airports? Why do we get two airports? We have a general aviation airport, but we also have the most successful base closure airport, a former Air Force base, the Phoenix Mesa Gateway Airport, which was an Air Force training center, which has been turned into a reliever, or we're turning into a reliever airport to Phoenix Sky Harbor.
Valerie Chang from the MacArthur Foundation. A lot of our comments today have sort of been focused on what's actually happening in the real economy, which is obviously clearly affecting what's going on. But I wonder if you could talk a little bit more about how much the challenge that governments at any level face is sort of a secular mistrust of what government does, or people's inability to really understand what government does for them. So it goes back to David's quote that from Doug Elmendorf, right? People want things, but they're not willing to pay taxes for them. So what challenges do you face, or how have you been able to think about engaging your public on the importance of things like concepts of public good or shared responsibilities? And is that, does that resonate with your citizens?
I just had the most bizarre conversation. I was at a senior citizen event just a couple of days ago, and this was actually with a woman that I know. And as I mentioned earlier, we cut out leaf collection. Now we, you know, we love trees. We plant. We, you know, everybody loves trees until the leaves fall. And so we said, it's a $400,000 service twice a year. We can't afford to do this anymore. So we're not mechanically picking up your leaves. Lady says to me, my constituents want this. She's a local neighborhood political person. And I said, well, we can't afford it. So, I mean, I'd love to engage in this conversation with you, but we just can't do this anymore. We're doing police, we're doing health, we're doing this. I said, well, we don't get anything from the city. I said, you got to be kidding me. If you call 911, a police officer or a firefighter is going to show up. Did you turn your spigot on this morning? I think water came through it. We have rec centers, libraries. I mean, I go through a laundry list of stuff. She listens very patiently. She says, but you're not going to change the policy on leaf pickup? I said, no, we're not doing it. Maybe you didn't hear my last press conference. We have no money. It was bizarre.
Very.
But if you just quit spending so much, you'd have money.
Right, exactly.
There is a lot of disconnect because people tend to be focused on a special interest that they have.
Right.
And they believe, okay, yes, we have problems, but you could just find a little bit more money for
that,
my
for,
thing.
For your thing.
Just for my thing. And so there's that problem with conception of how we spend our money. What I want to do in my next budget is I'm going to put a line item in there for waste, fraud, and abuse.
Absolutely.
Like $10 million. And then in the budget process, we're going to cut that.
We actually have a partnership with Western Kentucky University, and we use our leaf pickup. They actually mulch it and then sell it, and it's a revenue source for us. But with regard to engaging the public, I had citizens who were up in arms because we were expanding a school that resulted in the closure of an indoor pool. And so they wanted to know what we were going to do about it. And so what I did was I said, okay, let's talk about the alternatives. Let's see what we can do. If you would like to be part of a group that explores alternatives, let me know. One person contacted me. But what it did was it diffused the whole situation because they weren't mad at us because I didn't say, okay, we're going to take care of it. I put it off on, okay, you come to the table and work with us and we'll find a solution.
So can we get one in the back, man with a paper in his hand?
Hi.
Can you wait for the mic? Can you bring him a mic so all those millions of people who get up at 4 in the morning to watch C-SPAN can hear your question?
Hi, I'm Gene Sofer with the Susquehanna Group, and I was just wondering in the context of this discussion about joblessness and unemployment, whether or not you have youth strategies that are aimed out-of-work, out-of-school youth, where the unemployment rates are even much higher than for adults.
Yeah, that's where you're...
Summer jobs.
That's where you're public.
One of our successful stimulus programs was this summer. That's the first money we got. The first money we spent was for a youth program. So we got 1,000 kids... Well, kids 15 to 24 typically had to be low income and have some other problem in their life in order to qualify for the job. So we employed them. We spent the federal stimulus money. It was a wonderful thing, but that was a summer job. Now they've got to go back to their school or whatever they're doing. But the federal money is helpful in that, but we don't have a separate program for youth employment. My program is creating the jobs because if the jobs are there, the kids will be able to fill them.
Anybody else?
Yeah, we don't. Once again, one of the unfortunate things with not having enough money is that we place our children, which are number one most at risk, and number two, the poorest investment we make is not spending on our children because our police department will show up and say, please have a summer job, please have an after school, because we will spend the money. It'll be much greater, and you will spend it in my department rather than that. That being said, since we once again, it's a mathematical issue, revenues and expenses. We've teamed up with our school district to try and hit a long-term approach to things. And education, it's an old thing, but the way that we're going to raise our youth and our community is to raise our educational level and get those kids who are dropping out and those kids who are not moving on to college, which there is a way too large percentage, into training programs, into higher education, and try and get that going. Because we see the long term, that's the best kind of youth program we can have.
The public-private partnership really did come in handy there, and I used some of my experience with fundraising to spend months dialing for dollars with the corporate sector. $1,600, you can employ a kid for the entire summer. Some people actually gave more, didn't necessarily take all the kids themselves. We spend money on the city government. We used some federal money last summer. So we did about 1,500 just from the fundraising, 1,500 kids, summer jobs last summer through the private sector.
I'm afraid that's all the time we have. The Wall Street Journal had a conference the other day of CEOs, and one of them stood up and asked Rupert Murdoch what he thought was wrong with political discourse in the United States. I think the guy may have had Fox News in mind. And Rupert Murdoch's response was, the problem was we didn't have enough good people running for office in America. Well, I want to ask you all to thank these four people, not only for their time today, but these are obviously four people we're lucky to have in public service in America.